This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of The Overcomers, God's Vision for You to Thrive in an Age of Anxiety and Outrage, written and narrated by pastor and best-selling author Matt Chandler, and is available everywhere audiobooks are sold.
I remember we had a grad student that was working in our lab. This was when I was at Yale as a grad student from the UK, and he was just shocked that I was a scientist and a Christian. Like, I mean, his jaw physically dropped. He's like, you just couldn't conceptualize that someone could actually believe in a higher power and do science.
Mm.
And so I think he was one of the only few that was willing to verbalize that, but I know a lot of other people felt that as well. So that was something that I noticed early on. But then I also started to notice that there were sprinklings of people like me in similar situations who all felt like they were isolated right in their own pockets.
This is Where You're From, an origin story podcast at the intersection of faith and culture that digs into the influences and experiences that shape who we are today. Join us as we gain insight into the Bible's wisdom for all, regardless of where we're from. Hey, y'all, this is Rasul Berry. Thanks for joining me on Where You're From. This week, I want to share my conversation with Dr. Nee Addy. Dr. Nee Addy is a professor of psychiatry and cellular and molecular physiology at the Yale School of Medicine. Whew, that's a mouthful to say, and as you can tell from those titles, Dr. Addy is a brilliant guy. He investigates the neurobiological bases of substance use disorders, depression, and anxiety. He's also a contributor for the Whole Man book and video series from the Voices collection of our Daily Bread Ministries. You can find out more about Dr. Nee Addy and the Whole Man Project by clicking the links in the show notes or by visiting whereyourfrom.org. That's where, Y-A, from.org. Please join me as I ask Dr. Nee Addy, where you're from.
So my parents grew up in Ghana, West Africa, in Accra. So I'll say I'm Ghanaian, but I also am here in the States and I have a research lab at Yale University. So at the moment, I'll say I'm from Yale. We'll do a little bit of everything.
Interesting enough, when a lot of us would think to ask that question, we don't think about our parents, if our parents were born in someplace different than we were. But you do, which means that that's a significant part of your story. Tell me a little bit about the significance of growing up with Ghanaian parents in the United States?
Yeah, great question. Growing up, I definitely felt both parts of that identity as a black kid in the U.S. with roots in Ghana, trying to navigate in different spaces, knowing a little bit of the language of my parents, operating in English context, and trying to figure out where I fit in the world. So I'd say that's something that's kind of continued throughout the years. Even growing up, again, in the household of two people who identified as Christian, who both accepted Christ when they were growing up in Ghana and brought that with them to the States as well, and have been very open about having their time in the States as a God-made story. Mm. And so having all that history and tradition in my own walk, even as I came into my faith later in my own years. So I think a lot of that has shaped how I perceive the world and how I operate in the world. And obviously that's come full circle in a lot of ways and what I do in research that also touches on some aspects of race.
Okay, great. So, and where were you born?
So I was born in Durham, North Carolina.
Durham. Okay. So that was essentially where your story kind of emerges. But walk us through what it meant to be raised in a Ghanaian home. Like one thing you just kind of alluded to, that maybe there was another language than English that was spoken at home. You know, just paint the picture for those of us that maybe not know what it means to be raised Ghanaian.
Yeah. So for me, there's a huge family component to that too. So on my mom's side, I also had a lot of aunts and uncles who were also in different parts of the South. So be able to get together with family, to hear the language. I'm the oldest of four. So for me early on, I feel like I kind of eavesdropped here and there, and I picked up that language. I was able to comprehend it more than I could speak it, but I think that was part of my identity. But then I also carried that into different spaces. As I went to school, I was growing up in environments where not everybody looked like me. I'm thinking about, you know, am I from the States? Am I from West Africa? Am I from both places? And so I think as a teenager, that was something I was still trying to grapple with. And then even just thinking about, this is a little outside your question, but how Africans are perceived.
Yes, I was exactly going about to go there. Yes.
In the 80s thinking about, like, what do we assume about what happens in West Africa? Like, are people all famished and like, oh, I'm so privileged to live here in the U.S. where I have enough food. I mean, that's true to some extent, but that's also true everywhere.
Right.
So that also painted my perception. And I think as I became an adult, also realizing the aspects of what I thought about my own identity were false, and having to actually come to terms with that because I grew up here as so many other people did and had these perceptions, even though I had strong ties to Ghana as well. Some of this stuff I haven't thought about in years. So you're bringing it back up, which is interesting.
That's what we're here for. So I'm hearing you be raised where they're speaking. What's the language? Ga.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Perfect. So you're hearing another language at home, eating different foods. Mm-hmm. Some jollof rice, I'm imagining, mm-hmm. is part of the dish.
Yes, definitely.
The best in the world.
The best in the world. Thank you for clarifying.
But then you go out and you're in the midst of an American culture, mm-hmm. especially at the time, that probably the most that we're seeing about Africa is starving kids, mm-hmm. and ads that were ubiquitous,
yeah.
at the time.
Yeah.
When did you first realize that the way that people perceived your Africanness was much different than what you were experiencing at home on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah. So I'd say probably subconsciously, I thought about it every time I got together with relatives.
Okay.
Because then that's just family.
Right.
And so that's normal. Those are the people that you enjoy spending time with. And I probably didn't actually fully equate that, like, that perception didn't fit with my own experience. Mm. Or if my grandparents came over to visit too.
Right.
They weren't starving. So I think I probably put those in two different categories in my mind. I mean, it did also help, I would say, whenever we get together with other Ghanaians or other West Africans or Africans in general,
right.
in the States. So my parents came over in the 70s. This is early 80s, late 80s. So this is before, I mean, now we've had such a large influx of lots of folks from West Africa, more so in the 90s. Not that there weren't folks here before, but it's a different culture in that sense in the U.S. than it was back then. So I think for me, it was probably something that I slowly thought about over time. But when I first went to Ghana as a teenager, that was probably the real point where I actually realized that, okay, everything that I was thinking and just kind of imagining isn't actually what was true on the ground.
I had a Nigerian mm-hmm. classmate that came in middle school and an Ethiopian mm-hmm. classmate. And I went to a predominantly black school. Mm. And I look back and I just kind of grimace when I think about how the internalized racism, really, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. many of us in the African-American context, how we then perceived Africans, how that played itself out in their lives and some of the mm. things that they struggled with. Mm. So I'm just curious, in your own space, like, what do you remember about some of those misconceptions of you coming from your classmates or peers?
Yeah, like, people would just say things that would basically reference that, like, people from that part of the world are all emaciated.
Right.
And I think I even internalized that in the sense, you know, when you're getting to, like, middle school, you're trying to bulk up and all this. I don't remember if I said it or thought it, but thinking, oh, but I, you know, my parents are from West Africa, so I'm not able to be swole. That wasn't the word back
right.
then. But
I got you. So it wasn't like a specific moment that you remember of, like, a harsh word, but there was just a general sense of
internalization. Yeah.
Okay. So you now venture to the motherland for real for you, right? How old were you?
You're going to make me do math.
Okay. You're a teenager.
13, yeah. 13, 14, 15.
Young teenager.
There. Yeah.
Was there a special occasion, or was it just, we want you to meet your people and connect?
Yeah, more the latter. And this was something that had been long coming for a while. So okay. I've been anticipating, finally get to go back to where my parents grew up, meet a whole bunch of relatives, because both sides of the family had extended family that I hadn't met.
Okay. So there was a bit of anticipation.
Mm-hmm.
Were you eager? Were you excited? Were you nervous?
I'd say all of the above.
Okay.
And uncertain. I mean, this is my neuroscience hat coming on, but it's like, I just didn't know what to expect.
Right.
Like, because you have all these images in your mind, but you don't actually know what it's going to be like.
Okay.
When you get there on the ground.
All right. Now, what were the stakes as far as your parents were concerned? What did you perceive from them of the importance of this moment?
I think for them, just a chance for us to reconnect with family. Because, I mean, so many aunts and uncles who would always ask about us and who hadn't met us in person. I imagine they're saying, oh, when are you going to bring the kids back? Those types of things. So,
right.
And then again, just the Ghanaian culture, there's a very important tradition of the family house and kind of the main family house on each side. So going to that place and meeting all the relatives, a certain order with which you go about that. And so there was an expectation, I would assume, for them that we also knew a little bit about the culture and didn't come there without any clue of the Ghanaian tradition or how we were to kind of to navigate in that right. space. So I imagine that was some of it as well.
Okay. All right. So you get there. What are your first memories of arriving in Ghana? And I'm guessing Accra?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So I just remember it felt very busy to me. Just people everywhere. And it's even more so now, but I just feel like, wow, there's people everywhere. And I think we landed, I hope I remember this right, in the middle of the night too. So then, you know, your first transatlantic flight, sleep deprived. So all that like excitement, confusion, a little bit of delirium, and just trying to take it all in. Mm. But a positive experience. I feel like it took some time to kind of just settle in, but just, I was like, there are people everywhere.
I remember when I went to Cameroon and the airport, just getting out, and I remember the porters were grabbing your bag, mm-hmm. and it was in French, and I was confused, like, is this somebody trying to rip me off? Mm-hmm. And they were just trying to, work, right? Mm-hmm. But it was all very overwhelming mm-hmm. when you are stepping into a world that mm-hmm. you really have never been.
Yeah.
So you step into that world, and then you go to the family house, mm-hmm. right? So what's that moment like when you finally meet these family members who've been so eager to know who Nhi is, mm-hmm. and you're like on display?
Yeah. So, I mean, me and my siblings were all there. So I feel like we were all just trying to take it all in. It's actually hard to even grapple back and pull all those pieces out. Because having been three times, I feel like I've taken different pieces each time.
Right.
And so part of it, sorry, this is my neuroscience coming out too. I'm thinking, okay, now I'm thinking back, how much memory do I have of each of these pieces? But I feel like this, the pieces that just stuck out to me were just the connections that I was able to have with folks and feeling like I was home in a sense, but it also felt foreign at the same time. So it's almost like there was a little bit of a tension there too. Like, oh, this is a thing I've been really looking forward to.
Okay.
Have I missed out on something? And am I really taking it in as much as I should?
What felt like home versus what felt like foreign?
So I say it felt like home because everybody looked like me.
Mm-hmm.
These were family. People were saying things like welcome home. So there's definitely just connection and familiarity. At the same time, it's a totally different environment. So I'm not used to being in a large city with so many people where you have infrastructure and dirt roads all at the same time, all in the same place. So there was a little bit of almost chaos. So that felt foreign, but then also felt familiar too. Mm-hmm. Even if you'd asked me at that time, I don't know if I'd actually have been able to pull all these pieces apart because I was probably just kind of like taking it all in and processing it. But I feel like all that was happening. People were like, you're Ghanaian? No, you're American. No, you're, what are you in this sense?
It's so funny that when you mention the difference of like just the utter warmth and enthusiasm about your very being is something that is a unique experience that you mentioned, instead of people mislabeling like, oh, well, you wouldn't know anything about this because of where you're from, or, oh, that's a shame. Here it's like, welcome. We've been waiting for you. Mm-hmm. Right. Like that alone just feeds your soul.
Mm-hmm.
And yet at the same time, I have to point to the irony of the fact that coming from Durham to Accra, like a lot of people wouldn't think, okay, going from the United States to Ghana, the culture shock I'm experiencing is going from a small town to a big city.
Yeah, that's but, true. Yeah.
Like what is the size of Accra about?
Oh, right now, it's got to be at least, I would say, 2 million.
Yeah.
You can fact check me on that. But it's only grown since then as well, because more and more people from rural areas have moved into the city looking for work. And then you have vendors and all that. So it's just,
And Durham is not 2 million. No. So you have those experiences and you're just trying to take it all in.
Mm-hmm.
Do you come back different, you think?
I would say yes. I'd say came back feeling more grounded. And who I was and where I was from.
Yeah.
I mean, to play on the title of this podcast a little bit.
Okay. So you come back and at this point, obviously high school comes around and you're starting to think about your next steps. What were your options and how are you thinking about your future?
Yeah. So at this point we were actually living in Michigan. So came back to Michigan and there was part of that culture shock as well, being surrounded by family and just Ghanaians, and then coming back to the U.S., this time going to a school where I was one of a few Black kids in that school. So I think that was a little bit jolting in a sense as well. But I felt like it also, in a sense, I held that with me, but I also lost it faster than I would have anticipated. In the sense that after a few weeks, I was kind of right back and assimilated and back in my kind of environment and doing the same thing I was doing beforehand. Whereas I feel like when I went back to Ghana the second time, I actually held on to it a little bit longer. So in a weird way, I didn't hold it as long as I thought I would.
Right. Gotcha. What were your parents doing that had you going from North Carolina to Michigan?
Yeah. So both of my parents are physicians. My dad's a psychiatrist who does sleep medicine. My mom is a pediatrician. And to her credit, the story I always tell, she actually took 12 years off between doing her medical degree and then actually going back and doing her residency. To raise me and my three younger siblings.
Wow.
So that's a whole story in and of itself, just in terms of her like intellectual rigor to actually pull that off and to go back into a profession that is not light by any means.
Right. And not static.
No, not at all. Not at all. So that's, I mean, in terms of like my trajectory and even my career, I consider her to be like a great role model, example, right. hero, and just being able to do that.
Right. So two parents, mm-hmm. both physicians, mm-hmm. immigrants, mm-hmm. no expectations on you at all.
No, of course not. It took me a minute to actually catch that, but that actually goes back to one of your earlier questions about perception,
right?
About West Africans mm-hmm. here in the U.S., you know, how things were in Africa, and then perceptions of two physicians in the U.S.
Okay.
So I had that. That's a whole other aspect of where people would have a certain expectation. Well, I know what you're like, because you're one of those kids that has two parents who are doctors. And so navigating that, but then you're also Black, and then you're from West Africa. So like, it's almost like people couldn't even actually fit that in their own minds about which bucket of stereotypes they wanted to stick me into. So
right.
I'm very far from your question right now, but
that's okay. So to get back, mm-hmm. I made an assumption. You could tell me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. but because of the value of education mm-hmm. of immigrants, and on top of that, the fact that both of your parents had achieved such the highest levels, mm-hmm. there might have been some level of expectation about you going to college mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm, yep. and having a career related to that. Is that a...
That's a fair assumption.
Okay. So how were you thinking about that next step for you?
Yeah. So at that point, I think I was trying to figure out what those next steps would look like. Right. So this is eighth grade, ninth mm-hmm. grade. Fortunately for my parents, I had shifted my mindset. I don't know if this was rebellion, but early on, growing up, they had that expectation for me. I did not share that expectation whatsoever. Uh-huh. So I used to tell them growing up, as long as I did better than one other kid in the class... I'm cool. That I'm fine. I distinctly remember sitting with one or two of my parents each night, them trying to force me to do homework. I mean, the sad thing is like, if I got a D on an assignment, someone else failed,
right.
I'd be like, I'm cool. I wasn't the worst in the class.
Right.
Fortunately, when we got to Michigan, I actually kept that mindset.
Okay.
Failed my first science project. Again, one of the only Black kids in the class. Mm. So now I just blew my whole perception out of the water. Now I was the worst. Wow. No one else did worse than me. Now I'm thinking, these kids are thinking, well, this dumb Black kid from Atlanta who moved up here and can't even hang on. So that actually caused me to shift my mindset. By this point, I actually was getting a little bit more serious about academics, like right. actually just putting in the work.
Yeah.
And people were surprised, like, how did this kid actually get to this level based on what we saw early on? So for me at that point, I was starting to think about, well, what would those next steps look like? And I still had interest in psychology and the brain and things like that. But the where you're from thing still comes up because I still had people, you know, a few Black kids in that environment. I had my eyes on Duke at this time. And then hearing people be like, oh, that's a tough school to get into. And I'm not sure. Hmm. They wouldn't say, I don't know if you're cut out for it, but that would kind of be what was implied. And so that was part of my story as well. Hmm. And that just kind of gave me a fire inside too. Not only to prove them wrong, but because I had desire to go to these places and try and, you know, pursue education and think about things like whether that be medicine or science or something else, and just to kind of continue to go on that trajectory.
And I'm kind of noticing a kind of a thread with you where you like to push back on expectations, right? Oh, my parents think I'm going to be this big brainiac. I'll show you I'm going to have no expectations for myself. Oh, you don't think I have, exactly. to have expectations for myself. Well, let me show you and mm-hmm. then become a neuroscientist. So that's just something that you think is just part of your personality?
It must be. I don't think I've ever heard anyone pick up on it like that. So you're giving me some insight here, but I'm guessing it is there to a sense. Yeah.
But you said it wasn't just about proving them wrong. Mm-hmm. It was something else that somehow got energized mm-hmm. by this difference of expectation. Mm-hmm. You know what that might be? I'm going to throw something out.
Okay.
Let me throw something out. I think that deep down, there was something about you that you were always that intellectually curious and that somehow you suppressed it in order to make a point. But when you started to get really like serious about your life, it kind of just made sense that you would pursue something that was really who you were all along. Mm. What do you think about that?
That sounds good to me. You're making me reflect, because I mean, one of the things that I write about often too is just my kind of drive for excellence.
Okay.
Which sounds very contrasting to my drive for a lack of excellence
right.
as a middle schooler and just wanting to be
right.
next to the bottom of the rung.
But you even did that excellently, though, until you did. Like, once you realized, like, because you were like, it's like a certain strategic nature to be like, I'm going to be the one right above the bottom.
That's true.
You know what I mean?
I can't argue with that.
And then when you realize, oops, I messed that one up, you're like, okay, I might as well go all the way.
That's insightful. I mean, in a sense, it seems like it was there all along. And I mean, I even wonder if that's part of me trying to navigate. Mm.
holding on to who you are apart from all the expectations, either whether they were good expectations, high expectations, low expectations. It was like, I got to hold on to who I am. And so that if that means defying any and all expectations, I'm going
to
do it.
Yeah. And part of it was probably trying to shift to whatever I felt like the culture was telling me.
Right.
So I had that bent for excellence. But oh, it's supposed to look like this.
Okay.
Like, you know, growing up in Atlanta, one of my idols, Dominique Wilkins.
The human highlight reel.
All that. And then trying to fit into that mold.
Yeah.
Because I was passionate about the game of basketball. Maybe it wasn't a skill that I thought I could be, should be, any of that types of stuff.
Right.
But then, you know, just also I talked about like perceptions of a black kid or a kid whose parents grew up in Ghana and what that should or shouldn't look like.
Right.
So it's almost like maybe God had given me that drive for excellence, but I didn't know where to put it.
Got it.
And I was trying to put it in the wrong place.
Got it.
Clearly trying to be second from the bottom was not the right place to put
it. Got it. So now you put it in this place. So you have this high aspiration. I mean, Duke is top tier school in the country. So you're not shooting low here. Mm-hmm. And what happens with that aspiration?
Yeah, so I felt very blessed, and it's this full circle in a sense, because when I actually applied to Duke, I was fortunate to also get the Reginaldo Howard Scholarship. This is a scholarship that was named after one of the first presidents of the Duke student body who was black.
Okay.
Who unfortunately passed away in a car accident in the middle of his college training. And so his family and others actually started a scholarship in his honor. So in a sense, with all these pieces of me trying to figure out what my identity was, to be able to be kind of incorporated into that group and that community, to be able to meet his parents, like that was huge just in terms of kind of instilling.
And that ties a deeper into your family, your Ghanaian history, because family is such a big deal.
Yep.
Wow.
And so that was very much a part of my story and my trajectory. So I felt really like honored and, and blessed to have that opportunity. There was also still that mixed bag of perception coming in too. Because now you have this thing where people are like, okay, well, this is a black kid with two parents who are doctors, who's getting a scholarship to go to this school. But where does that fit in terms of opportunity for other people? I even had an internal tension there too. So I don't think I've ever said this, you know, publicly or on air on a show, but had a full ride to go to the University of Michigan. Before I found out about Duke scholarship. So that also became a point of tension. You know, even growing up in a household of physicians who did well, but having roots in Ghana and knowing that when my parents came here, they didn't have means. You know, my dad came here last minute because of an opportunity that opened up. I've shared this publicly before, but he shared stories with me about him and my mom having conversations about where to splurge for ice cream for their young son.
Wow.
So I know when they got here, they didn't have much.
Gotcha.
And so there was also a part of, well, this is where they are now. People don't know the history.
Right.
And I think that got seeded into me at a young age where I'd say I'm a really frugal person. Right. Part of it may have come from that. So when I get this college decision about full ride here or no money here at this point, go to Michigan or Duke without having that scholarship, all that kind of came into the mix as well.
So it sounds like you decided on Duke before you knew about the Reginald Howard Scholarship. How long did it take you once you got to Duke to realize you wanted to study neuroscience?
That's a funny question. Part of me can say that it probably always was there,
right,
but I don't think I realized it. So I still had that interest in like the psychology and taking those types of classes.
Yep.
There's another part of the story because I told my dad growing up that I didn't want to be anything like him.
Yes.
I don't know if that's excellence or what. It's that same theme.
Yeah, it's that self-determined identity thing, right?
And so obviously I failed at that, I always tell people, because I am an associate professor of psychiatry. My dad always says, but you're not an MD like me, but still something pulled me back. So I'd say that interest was there and I probably didn't really acknowledge it for a while. But sophomore year, I started to get some research experience in labs and things like that and started to kind of get an itch for the science. Also was talking to different psychology professors, trying to figure out if I should be a psychology major or a biology major. Had that psychology professor tell me that I should be a biology major, which I found that offensive. Because it made me feel like, one, I'm not cut out for your discipline, but I think he actually saw the passion that I had for biology. So part of it was just having professors that would give me opportunities to actually get engaged in research and learn a little bit more about it. So it kind of grew over time.
You also mentioned that at some point your parents' faith, seeing God's direction and path and bringing him to the States, that was also something that came to you at a later time.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. So for me, that was in high school. And part of that was just being able to, again, kind of get outside of my own comfort zone and my own bubble, so to speak.
Right.
So in high school, I was part of a youth group. We would do different mission trips, go to different parts of the Midwest at the time. And so we had times where we actually go and work in Chicago, in different parts of the city, work in areas that were like at the border in Caprini Green of three different gang territories. So like real you know, stuff that people were walking through. And I'd see people who were there who felt like they were missionaries to those environments. Mm. People who could have had high paying jobs, who felt a call to actually go and serve in those places. And I was like, something's different here. Up to that point, I kind of perceived my faith or Christianity as something of me just trying to be a good person.
Right.
And I was like, I'm a pretty good kid. You know, there's some things that I ignored, but you know, that was my perception going in. And I was like, there's something different about these folks. They're not here trying to check boxes. There's something that's calling them to that space. And then interacting with those who are living on the streets because they were in dire circumstances, who also had a really deep faith. I remember one man in particular who felt called to give away half of his meal every morning. I'm like, this man has no job, very little means, and still he's giving away half of his meal. It's like something is different here. So just talking to those folks, realizing that they had a personal relationship with Christ and it was something that was deep to them, kind of shifted my mentality. So I distinctly remember going back home after that trip and just thinking more about what does that actually mean? It actually changed how I read the Bible. It changed how I prayed. And from that point, I felt like, okay, I think beforehand, you know, you do things kind of ceremoniously, but I was like, I am actually praying to a God who's listening. And there was just kind of a shift that happened there. I wouldn't say it's a straight path, because even when I got to college, I had that. This is my parents' faith. Is this real? I'm not really sure if I believe this anymore. All those types of things came up as well. And part of that was just me spending time in prayer and just really wrestling with questions, talking to other people, and feeling like God showed up and showed himself to me in a way that I can't even like tangibly, concretely describe. I just had a sense that, no, this is real.
That's something to see someone in such dire straits as this homeless man feel called. That means that like the God that he serves sees him with the same type of dignity to have expectations on his life, but then that he would have the sense of generosity to give even the little that he had away. I could see how that would have an impact on you. Did you find any kind of spiritual community at Duke while you were there?
Yeah, so I was really fortunate to be involved in InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. So I had upperclassmen who would take time to come to our freshman dorm, lead a Bible study. So again, like that relational aspect, really just spending time listening to people, helping people work through those hard questions, people who were generous with their time and kind of studied the Word of God with us, you know, lifelong friends. And that was definitely a deep impact
now,
as well.
I'm curious about, like, because when I think about neuroscience, right, and biology, I don't think hot bastion of, like, Christian fellowship is what one would experience in those disciplines. How did your faith inform your academic disciplines, and how did you navigate that whole space, which in some ways can sometimes be seen as oppositional?
So navigation has changed over the years. I think early on, I felt very solo in it. So it was almost like I went into my scientific discipline and then I stepped out of it to at least get the encouragement from others, and then stepped back into it. So that was kind of happening back and forth. There's also a little bit of a shock factor that other scientists had at that time too. So I remember, and this isn't meant to be locale specific, but I remember we had a grad student that was working in our lab. This was when I was at Yale as a grad student from the UK. And he was just shocked that I was a scientist and a Christian. Like, I mean, his jaw physically dropped. He's like, you just couldn't conceptualize that someone could actually believe in a higher power and do science. And so I think he was one of the only few that was willing to verbalize that, but I know a lot of other people felt that as well. So that was something that I noticed early on. But then I also started to notice that there were sprinklings of people like me in similar situations who all felt like they were isolated in their own pockets.
Okay, so for those that might be listening and go, I have that same question. How did you respond to this British colleague?
When we come back, Dr. Nee Addy will share how he reconciles his work as a neuroscientist with his faith and how he sees neuroscience finally catching up to what God has been saying through Scripture. That's coming next on Where You're From.
This episode is brought to you by Church Salary. Coming up with a reasonable salary range for church staff has never been easy. There are so many details to consider before setting compensation for church staff, and you're probably asking yourself questions like, are we paying too little or too much? What benefits do we offer employees? What's a reasonable housing allowance?
Church Salary believes that offering competitive and fair compensation helps keep people in ministry. Using the expansive church-specific compensation database and powerful salary calculator tool, you can also make better compensation decisions so your staff can focus on their ministries. Start with Church Salary's annual membership today to run unlimited customized reports and get access to our member-only content. Ready to start making better compensation decisions? Get started at churchsalary.com.
Hey, y'all, before we get back to my conversation with Dr. Nee Addy, I wanted to say a quick thank you to all of you who have been with us for season 6 and to let you know you should keep an eye out for a special episode coming your way in early June. More details to follow. Finally, we're so excited about the work that's been going on with the Whole Man book and video series. To learn more, go check out our website at experiencevoices.org/wholeman. That's experiencevoices.org/WHOLEMAN. Now let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Nee Addy on where you're from.
So I think I just was a matter of fact. This can happen. This does exist. I don't feel like this compromises my faith. I feel like I get to study God's creation when I'm studying aspects of the brain. And that wasn't something that I think he was able to grasp, but it also just gave him a different perception. Mm-hmm. I've also noticed over the years that as I've been in different environments, there are lots of people who've had intellectual or scientific oppositions to faith.
Right.
But getting back to relationship, whenever I get to know those folks more, every single time, there's always something deeper.
Mm.
Someone will have gone through something in their life and they'll say something like, well, I have issues with the man upstairs.
Right.
Or why did this evil thing happen here? Why did I go through this really difficult situation? So there's always something beneath the surface. That
right.
There was an intellectual aspect of it, but I think God was also showing me that people are hurting
right.
and have been through things and that I also need to be able to kind of meet them where they're at. And he's actually opened opportunities where I've been able to bring people through God's help back into relationship with God because they were able to watch me as a scientist operate in both places and have enough curiosity where before they were told that their faith and their science were in opposition and have realized that that's actually not the case.
You describe that so naturally. Like, I'm just looking at how God created the world, mm-hmm. right? Why do you think that people have that sense that it's such a bigger chasm than you see?
Yeah, so I think part of that just goes back to the way we're even taught about evolution.
Mm, okay.
Because we're taught basically like it's one or the other. Either it's evolution
right.
without God, or God created everything and it wasn't by evolution whatsoever.
Right.
And so that almost sets a foundation that these are incompatible.
Mm.
And so part of that goes back to like how we're educated and what we talk about in our school systems around things like scientific theory. But it also points to a bigger picture too, which actually gets to some of the work that I do around mental health too, because we keep setting up these different dichotomies, like either it's science or it's God,
okay,
as if the two don't meet,
right?
Which we don't do with other things in the world.
Right.
We don't say like, either I'm going to drive on the road and use the mechanical engineering from the car or God's going to fly me somewhere. Just but like,
right.
I mean, it's nonsensical, but we do that with our science a lot. We do that with mental health. And so I think it's a bigger right. challenge that we have into how we approach things on a day-to-day basis.
I'm glad you went there because, you know, you study neurobiology. Why did you decide, of all the different ways to understand why people do what they do, right? There's the whole counseling way, there's mm-hmm. psychology, but you went on a more, I guess you could say, foundational level mm-hmm. of looking mm-hmm. at cells and mm-hmm. why look at it that way? And yeah, let's talk about the connection between mental health and faith.
Yeah, I think part of it was just that curiosity that I had for like how and why. So even going all the way back to your question earlier about like next steps when I was thinking about college, I actually thought about engineering too.
Right.
Because I was like, why do things work the way they do? Who designed it?
Right.
And who allowed that to happen?
Hmm.
And so I think for me, it was just that inherent curiosity to really understand how God has designed us and how our brains actually work. Because the more and more I study, the more and more we study as a field, the more we realize that we don't know.
Mm.
So, you know, even thinking about something like dementia, where people start to not be able to remember things and know like what's happening that allows that to occur. But even quote unquote simple things like eyesight.
Mm.
Like, I mean, if you think about the neuroscience of eyesight, it's pretty fascinating. So I think just having that drive and curiosity was kind of what pulled me into the neuroscience field. And then all this opportunity to actually help people understand why we do what we do has actually come after the fact.
Got it. Got it. So in your study, you have shared that you look at addiction, mm-hmm. depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. Let's start with addiction. Mm-hmm. And what do you know and what have you learned about addiction that is something that you think is important to communicate to others?
Yeah, the main thing I think that I've appreciated more as we've been doing our work is how, just even broad, even before we get to addiction, how our experiences change our brains.
Hmm.
So, I mean, it sounds like a straightforward comment. At the same time, it also sounds very odd. Like, why would something be changing our brain? I guess we, you know, as human beings, we often think about our brain as kind of this static.
Right.
This is what we have. That's how we operate in the world. But to think about how all the experiences we have change our brains can feel either comforting or discomforting.
Mm.
That's even more so the case when we talk about substance use and addiction and substance misuse. Mm. So in the lab, we've been doing a lot to study how does long-term exposure to different substances impact the brain and how does that actually change people's behavior?
Mm.
And so that's been really fascinating to look at, but then also think about what are the ways that we can actually cause further changes to help people actually navigate through that. If someone has been misusing a substance and is having a lot of withdrawal or relapse and trying to kind of navigate into a better space, maybe they're not paying as much attention to their family or their vacation or their work as they should be. And what are the different ways that we can understand what's happening in their brain to actually help people get to a better place? It's really been a piece of curiosity and conversation for me as well, even with people who are navigating through substance use challenges as well.
Okay. So that all sounds very mechanical.
Mm-hmm.
How does faith enter into that work? There are a lot of people who work in the field of trying to support and help people mm-hmm. break addiction habits mm-hmm. and things like that. How have you seen faith matter in this issue?
Yeah. So I say in two ways. One of it is just in how we look at each other mm-hmm. as human beings.
Right.
And that goes back to your earlier question about how do I operate as a Christian
yeah.
in a scientific endeavor? So part of it is how I actually see other people who are about the science too. Mm. I see them as human beings made in God's image.
Right.
And so that's going to impact how I interact with them on a day-to-day basis, how I treat people, how we all show up and how we actually support one another.
Right.
I'll say the same thing when it comes to kind of navigating through addiction as well. The neuroscience is one avenue of that. God has given us different tools that we can use, faith and spiritual practices, prayer, meditation, being in community, all those things can help people navigate through addiction. All those things also impact the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Think about different psychological tools that also impact the brain. And so I think about these things really holistically.
Right.
And not, this doesn't minimize faith by any sense, mm-mm. but it's one of multiple tools that we have to actually navigate through some of these challenges.
Yeah. And I think the scriptures support that. For instance, in Philippians 4, where there's Paul in prison mm-hmm. for sharing his faith, but yet talking about joy
mm-hmm,
and, you know, mm-hmm. brethren, whatever is good, whatever is pure, whatever is praiseworthy, mm-hmm. think about these things
mm-hmm.
and the peace of God, which passes all understanding, shall guard your heart and your mind in Christ Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
As a neuroscientist, right? Like, break down how you see that verse in light of your training and your faith.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm smiling because that's a verse that when I'm giving sermons, I often reference.
Okay.
And there is a lot of neuroscience that's baked into it
okay.
as well. I mean, some psychological practices that are baked into mm. it. One, just a shift in perspective, like our perspective of ourselves
right.
or God's perspective of us.
Right.
Which one is healthier?
Mm. Hmm. And even the idea that how one thinks about oneself mm-hmm. can be healthy or unhealthy.
Exactly.
Right.
Which can then impact how we actually navigate through the world.
Gotcha.
So there's a lot of different psychological practices that will actually focus on that. How do we think about ourselves? How do we think about our situation?
Right.
If we do that from a perspective that God mm-hmm. has given us through the scripture, mm-hmm. that's going to change how we actually approach those situations.
Mm-hmm.
If we do that long enough, it's actually going to change aspects of our brain as well. So when mm-hmm. people are in very stressful situations, people talk about like the limbic regions of the brain, the fight, flight, or freeze responses. If you can kind of engage higher order thinking processes and think about not that we have ultimate control, but that mm-hmm. we can change our perspective of how we approach those things,
yeah.
that can actually dampen some of those responses.
Right.
There are tools that people can use to actually strengthen that response.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people get stuck in a certain type of response, it can actually move out of that. So when I hear that verse, I'm not calling Paul a neuroscientist, but it's us as neuroscientists catching up to what God has already taught us through
right.
the scripture about how God gives us peace through right. his presence, through his word. But also I would say this is not, you know, necessarily written in the biblical text, but from the practice
right.
of continuing to focus on what God has taught us will actually change our brains and help us to navigate through those
That's
situations.
That's fascinating. Another thing, so you started with addiction, but mm-hmm. then you also expanded to depression and
mm-hmm.
anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
In that same chapter in Philippians 4, we see, do not be anxious mm-hmm. about anything,
yep.
but in everything with prayer and petitions, with thanksgiving, make your request known to God. Help us understand the significance of anxiety, and even Paul directly going right there saying, yeah, don't be anxious. Instead, do this.
Yeah.
Pray.
Yeah. I'm laughing again because that's the other verse that I often quote in sermons. I often talk about it in two ways. One, as you mentioned, there's so much there that Paul is helping us and directing us in the way that we should think about these things and focusing on not just getting stuck in the anxiety,
right,
but giving thanks in that.
Right.
And so part of the practice that people use in a lot of psychological interventions is changing perspective about a certain situation. Mm. So if you can change your mindset and think about not that the situation is good, but good things that have also happened and how that can help people shift how they navigate through certain situations. But the other piece I always talk about, which is actually outside your question, is how sometimes we can misuse that verse and feel that if we are anxious, then now we've sinned. Because the scripture says, do not be anxious.
Right.
So if I have an anxious feeling, it doesn't mean that I've done something sinful. And sometimes people will get stuck there and get in a loop of anxious thoughts because they're anxious and about the anxiety. Mm. But it's instructing us what to do to hand that to the Lord.
Yeah.
Do not be anxious, but in all things by prayer and petition. We have a recipe for how we're actually supposed to respond to that.
So you're reading the scripture. You're like, oh my gosh, I'm seeing science. When you're seeing the science, you're thinking about the scripture. So like eventually you decide to not just study this on one level, but to actually teach. Tell us a little bit about that part of your journey.
Yeah. So the teaching that I do is really in a mentoring kind of role. So I do some courses here and there for medical students, for some of the undergraduates, but I also have students in the lab who are learning to do the research. So a lot of it is the hands-on teaching, having people learn about these different aspects of the brain and these cells and processes and pathways. I do get a lot of energy, I will say, from our undergrad students that come into the lab, maybe because some of us who've gotten a little bit older in our journey have gotten a little bit tired along the way or jaded. So it's always kind of good to have that energy. But for me, the mentorship piece is huge. Mm. I'd say that's one of the reasons, you know, other than the passions that God has given me, that I'm in this role, because I've had so many people who've sown into my life as mentors.
How did you end up at Yale? Like, what was the decision-making process of being there?
That was a journey as well. So when I applied, I'm going to get the timing wrong. Hopefully I don't get myself in trouble. My wife and I were engaged at some point along the journey. So there was a little bit of a pairing that was, and that's how I don't want to misspeak right now, because that could be bad. So that was part of it. But part of it was also her encouragement and seeing places where she felt like I had that mentorship and where I had that interest and I had that support. And so I actually was intentionally trying not to go to a high caliber Ivy League institute.
Right.
But I think she saw that, okay, this seems like it's an area that fits you. It seems like there's a passion there, there's opportunities. And so that was a journey that we prayed through together, and we both ended up at Yale early on. And again, just kind of had that support from day one. I went back as a faculty member, but had that same mindset. So when my mentor was saying, oh, I'd love to see you end up at a place like Stanford or Yale, in my mind, I was thinking, I'm not trying to do that, and I'm hoping I don't.
And I guess what I'm seeing underneath that is this idea of, like, you know what society expects as the ultimate level of making it, and you don't want to buy into this false sense of what that might mean, because your set of values and your set of what matters is not the same as that. So maybe that's not the right thing, because I don't want to be tempted into trying to chase after what everybody else is.
Yeah.
So I got to ask you, because you mentioned, you know, your wife, when did y'all meet, and tell us a little bit about her?
Yep. So we met in undergrad at Duke. So I was 1 year ahead of her in school. So I actually took time off in between trying to figure things out. So I remember one day, my sister and I actually went to college together too. My dad came down to visit us. He was like, your beard's looking a little trim today. Is there a someone or a something? I was like, I can't hide anything from this man. This is a psychiatrist. So that's a story in and of itself. But I've been blessed that we were able to meet early on in our lives, you know, as late teenagers, got married in our early 20s. And so I feel like God's been very faithful, blessed me in ways that I didn't deserve to have a partner like that. And we've been able to watch each other grow and grow up. And so to be able to see kind of the different spheres that God has opened up, the way we've been able to kind of share things with each other, support each other, even through, you know, some of the challenges that have come up of walking into these spaces, being Christians in non-Christian institutions in science. And it's been fun to kind of see her blossom into her role as well with her PhD in science education and what she does a lot around faculty development and teaching.
So you have kind of talked about the importance in your various trips of going to Ghana and getting pieces of yourself, of understanding identity, understanding the world. I'm curious about how the Ghanaian roots may have shaped your understanding of community. You wrote a piece in the Whole Man devotional book about brothers in community. I'm thinking about the importance that you said of family, right? What are some of the things that you've discovered about your culture, about your roots that have helped you see the world better?
Yeah, so I'll come back to the question. One thing I was going to mention is you mentioned this kind of, well, I don't want to call it rule breaking, but not trying to fit into a certain mold.
Sure.
That has definitely continued into my current position. So there are certain expectations of the type of science journals that people publish in. It'd be nice to have a paper in this place or that place. Every time I hear that, I can internally feel my rebellion happening. And I feel like that has actually, in an odd way, opened up opportunities for me to be able to step into the space and to craft things in a way that is not typical. So as a scientist, I do publish scientific papers with a group. I don't publish in those journals per se, but I also do things that just scientists don't do in terms of hosting conversations with clinicians, faith leaders, entertainers, professional athletes, mental health advocacy, speaking about diversity, equity, and inclusion at businesses, speaking at churches, giving sermons. So all this, it wasn't intentional, but I feel like God kind of opened up the door for those opportunities because I wasn't fitting a certain mold.
Right.
But the community piece has been huge in that as well, because every time I step into those places, I feel like I'm stepping into a community, I'm engaged in community with others, and we're having a conversation together. So I think that does go back to some of those aspects of the Ghanaian roots and just seeing how important it is for people to be in community to navigate through things. And the neuroscience actually ties that in as well. So there's a certain molecule that people often talk about, oxytocin, that was discovered because it's important for birth and contraction. It also sets up the bond between mother and child. But it's also a hormone that's released when people are in community together.
Wow.
And it's also protective. So, you know, we do a lot of our work in rodents to try and understand what's happening in the brain. Rodents will actually take substances that people will take as well. If you put them in community together, they're less likely to take the substance or to take it to excess.
Wow.
If you do studies in rats and you put them through a stressful situation, they'll actually console each other and those levels of oxytocin will increase. And so there are all these kind of scientific components that really highlight the importance of that community. So I'd say, you know, I've seen people study that from a scientific standpoint, but I've also seen how God's designed us to be in community. And I've seen how that's worked with everything that we went through with the pandemic, everything with George Floyd, to be able to see communities that were able to have authentic community and to pull back the layers and not just have lip service, but say, okay, as a Black man, I'm here to listen to your story. I'm here with you. I'm going to walk alongside you to see the power of that, what I know about the science, and see people actually navigate together and grow stronger together and actually try and make a change. It's just been kind of a full circle.
Man, it just opened me up to thinking about the Garden of Gethsemane differently. You know, Jesus praying and asking, pleading the disciples, stay up with me. Help me raise my oxytocin levels, you know. He saw the importance of community, you know, in that sense, just to even help him get through this incredible ordeal. You mentioned in our previous conversation that we had one of the folks that you've partnered with to do these kind of events. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So the first big event we did back in 2018 was with Lecrae. One picture I often paint, even just talking about some aspects of his journey, is, you know, from an outward standpoint, you say, okay, very successful individual, multiple businesses, Grammy Awards, New York Times bestselling author, all those pieces. But I was able to connect with him through a mutual friend to really talk about aspects of science and mental health and where his passion was. And so in a way, I feel like God used that opportunity to also, similar to my aspects of my story, to show me where my passion was and to also create an opportunity for us to partner together to have some of these broader conversations.
Wow.
So I invited him to come speak at Yale back in 2018, and we did a town hall conversation on Yale's campus around mental health, faith, culture, and social justice. It's a lot of hot button topics.
All of them. Almost all of them.
But we were able to really get a cross section of the community to show up to that event.
Yeah.
Lecrae was really vulnerable about his story. Also did a lot of homework to find out about the pulse on campus. And so it was an event that really spoke to people. There were students that came to that that said that was the most powerful event they'd been on since they'd been at campus. People were being very vulnerable with their own stories in a room of 200 people.
Yeah.
They were sharing that with Lecrae and with the pastor of the Black Church at Yale, Dr. Orlando Yarborough, and just a really, I don't even know the best way to describe it, but just a really God-orchestrated moment to to see the levels at which people opened up. And that really just opened my eyes to how much of a need that was, there was for that across the world.
How has your journey and even going to Ghana changed how you see yourself when you look in the mirror?
That's a good question. So I was in Ghana this past summer, so 2023, and it was my third time going back to Ghana. Granted, I hadn't been back in over two decades, so there was a big gap in time from this time to the last time. But one of the things that really caught me off guard, I had been in Ghana for about 24 hours and saw my reflection in the mirror. And this sounds odd as a neuroscientist, but I felt like my image had changed, which intellectually I know that hadn't happened. That doesn't make any sense. But the fact that I had been in Ghana and seen people that looked like me for 24 hours actually changed how I saw myself in the mirror. When I saw myself in the mirror, I felt like I looked more familiar and I belonged. So reflecting, I was realizing that I had gotten very used to operating in spaces where I stood out. And I had become accustomed to that and all that comes with that. You know, all the walking into a room wondering if people are going to perceive me as friend or foe, so to speak, as someone they want to work with, someone they're hesitant about, someone that's a threat. And then to step back into Ghana and not have any of that there just changed how I perceived my own image, in a sense that this is a place where I belong. And I don't even have to think about all those aspects, but that's something that's really resonating and still sitting with me pretty heavily.
This is Where You're From. I'm Rossel Berry. And remember, it's not just about where you're at, it's also about where you're from. This show was produced by Ryan Clevenger and Mary Jo Clark. I also want to thank listeners Benjamin Crank and Stephen Hallbert for their help in supporting and promoting Where You're From. Thanks, y'all.
Where You're From is part of the Voices Collection from Our Daily Bread Ministries.
This episode was brought to you in part by the Better Samaritan podcast, where Jamie Ayton and Kent Annan discuss everything from simple acts of kindness to complex humanitarian challenges with their guests. Want to learn how to faithfully do good better? Find insights at The Better Samaritan.